can't go here to the negotiations. They're ruled out by the contract. But you can go to the purposes of the agreement. This court specifically has said in the Citadel Holding Corporation case that when you go to look for the intent and you should construe an agreement consistent with its purposes, the best place to look is the recitals that begin the agreement. And the stated purpose of this agreement, the central purpose, and if you look at A697 and A736, they state the purposes. It's reducing youth smoking is the bottom line purpose. That's what the parties to the MSA centrally were about, culminating decades of public health problems caused by this product. The core purpose of this agreement is to reduce youth smoking. It doesn't say the core use of the purpose of this agreement is to prevent criticism of tobacco companies. It says the core purpose is to reduce youth smoking. Now, there are limitations in the agreement on the way that that is to be done. But black letter contract law would say that those limitations should be construed to the extent there are choices between plausible interpretations consistent with achieving the core stated purposes of the agreement. Here, reducing youth smoking, which calls for the narrowest plausible construction of any restriction. And that is normal black letter contract law. Similarly, it is black letter contract law in this state that to the extent there are alternative plausible readings of a contract, the court should select the one most consistent with public policy. The MSA itself recites, signed by the state, recites that it is a core public policy of the state of Delaware to protect the public health and to reduce youth smoking. Reducing youth smoking is the heart of, the reason it's the heart of the agreement is that it's the, youth smoking is the heart of the problem of tobacco use. Data, and it's in the record, shows that the people who die from smoking cigarettes and suffer disease from smoking cigarettes start as kids. Adults don't start. Very, very seldom. Kids do, and that's where smokers come from. Stopping youth smoking is the key to that. And so that's why the agreement focuses on that. But it is the public policy of the state to reduce that. And again, that is a canon of interpretation, not that trumps the language, not that causes or should suggest that the court should reach a conclusion inconsistent with the language, but that counsels the court to select a plausible meaning among alternative meanings that are permissible that most favors the public health. Again, that favors the broadest freedom to tell the truth about tobacco to kids, the broadest freedom to reach these sensation-seeking kids who are the most at risk, who don't listen to top-down messages.
I don't think your opponent disagrees with telling the truth about tobacco. Their concern is what you're saying about tobacco executives, and the hypnosis one is the example.
Well, it's critically important, and there is a great deal of rigorous scholarship which shows that with sensation-seeking teens, the kids who smoke are and who are open to smoking, are a group of kids who are not open to top-down biology lessons or lectures about the effects of cigarettes, per se. There are kids who listen to that, just as there are adults. But the kids who begin to smoke are kids who see smoking as a way to rebel against authority. They are kids who are susceptible to messages in advertising, which suggest that tobacco is a way to do that. It's a way to be a rugged individualist, to be the Marlboro man, etc. And it is very clear that in order to reach those kids, you have to speak to them in their own voice. You can't talk down to them. You've got to allow them to feel like they're taking control and that not smoking is actually a way to rebel. The idea is to align the behavior that you want with the psychological, emotional need of the child to rebel. And so, and further, the idea is to have the advertising deal with the billions of dollars worth of advertising that's out there trying to get them to smoke, the advertising put out by the tobacco companies. Understand that that advertising is put out there for a purpose. It's put out there because people want to make money off you buying cigarettes. It's not because this is a safe cigarette and adults wouldn't put it out there if it weren't safe for you. It's a very dangerous product. It's out there because adults make money from it. Those are very important messages. They're not put out to vilify. They're put out to allow these sensation-seeking kids to be educated consumers, and it's critically important. I'd like to, if I might.
But a personal attack and vilification would accomplish the same thing. wouldn't it?
Well, I actually suppose it's conceivable that it could, and the agreement clearly demarks vilification and personal attack as something that the National Public Education Fund should not be used to do. But the question for this court is what those words mean, what kind
and
of expression.
My point is that the fact that there's a particular methodology that works does not ipso facto mean that methodology is okay.
I agree completely, Your Honor. It doesn't at all ipso facto mean it. But what the customary tools of contract interpretation tell us is that in choosing between plausible meanings, and the meanings that the Court of Chancery reached and that we've advocated are more than plausible. They're in dictionaries. The idea that vilification is vicious and defamatory, i.e. false, that's in the dictionary. The idea that personal means private subject matter, that is a core, normal meaning of the word personal. The idea that an attack isn't just criticism, but an attack is a vicious or hostile verbal assault, that's in the dictionaries. We've cited them. So the question is, are those the meanings that the court should select? Or should the court select some very watered-down meaning that would prohibit all discussion of or all criticism of tobacco companies?
Well, and should the court be concerned that if someone looked at that ad on hypnosis, you know, you're saying anybody reading the ad's going to know you probably ought to not smoke. But someone else might decide maybe we ought to go around and find all the tobacco executive houses because, you know, those are bad people who are making a lot of money. And doesn't that kind of move over into the personal realm when you connect whatever message you want to convey with showing individual houses of people that are purportedly successful? I'm not saying you depicted any individual's house, but it is a little bit of a mixed message, wouldn't you say?
Well, I believe that the core message of that ad is that understand that people profit from selling cigarettes, and cigarettes kill hundreds of thousands of people every year. That message gets read in conjunction with the other messages that are associated with this brand to tell kids, be skeptical consumers. There are people who profit from this. It's not intended to personally attack in the sense of commenting on anything other than the commercial activity that supports the tobacco business. And it's a very important message. And it's from the standpoint of vilification, it's not done in an abusive tone, and no facts are false. And from the standpoint of personal attack, it's a very broad group, as was suggested before. Tobacco executives, the vice chancellor, said that personal requires some sense of meaningful identification of the attack on an individual. And talking about tobacco executives as an entire group doesn't have that sort of specifying quality. And further,
the reference in the contract to collectively?
Well, certainly collectively, if it defined a sufficiently small group or a string of identifications or a very small group, could serve that function. Tobacco executives, we believe, is simply too broad of a group. We also don't think that ad has a hostile or bitter tone. It is really, in contrast to an ad that's been much talked about, the Demon Awards, which was an ad done by the Florida Truth Campaign, which the parties have conceded constituted the model of what vilification or personal attack was. That's an ad in which the tobacco executive is pictured as damned and in hell, with flames rising behind him as he gleefully accepts an award for being the greatest killer, killing more people than murderers and the peddlers of illicit drugs, while Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and members of the Ku Klux Klan watch and applaud.
That's vilification, correct?
That is vilification. That is vilification.
But it seems like that this is going to be an endless stream of the courts becoming the critic, because you're acknowledging that you're pushing the window on the vilification in your screening. I mean, your screening is, you have categories. Is it one chance in three of being vilification and personal attack, four chances in nine of being, one in ten? It's like it's going to be a constant stream.
Your Honor, we took the extraordinary step of disclosing our privileged review memoranda because we wanted it to be extremely clear how seriously this board, which is composed a majority of public officials, two governors, two attorney generals, two state legislators, and the rest public health associated individuals, how seriously they've taken this. And every ad is reviewed multiple times with an eye towards trying to ensure that the bylaws provisions are complied with. And so we disclose that information. Our ultimate view, as is represented in our cross appeal, is that actually the drafters of the MSA did not contemplate that Your Honors or Vice Chancellor Lamb would sit as the super reviewing court to look at every single advertisement ever published by the American Legacy Foundation to decide does it cross a line, to exercise your judgment with respect to whether these terms are violated. That is a burden on the courts, and it is, frankly, a terrible opportunity for these critically important resources, these resources that are needed to get kids not to smoke, be frittered away with multimillion-dollar litigation that drags on for years in the courts by entities that are motivated potentially to do just that. We believe, for the reasons set forth in our cross-appeal, that that wasn't contemplated. However, to the extent, Your Honor, that it is a justiciable issue, and to the extent that we're wrong and the MSA does provide a vehicle for the tobacco companies to sue my client and to go ad by ad, then you've got to do your best to try to figure out what those words mean and apply them. And we think what they mean is denoting extreme forms of speech. You know, there are other options, as was suggested earlier by Your Honor. There were other, they could have had some clarity and could have had a contract that said the things that Mr. Parkins said the contract means. It could prohibit criticism. It could prohibit disparagement. It does not. It chooses much more extreme words.
Question. Going back to what you just said, something you said earlier, as to the court's continued review, is that it seems to rise up in the briefs that we can eliminate this. ALF can eliminate this. We'll just use the base funds. Is that in the cards? In other words, we're just going to use the base funding, which has no restrictions. Now that was deemed moot below, but we believe that
the Vice Chancellor was clearly within the scope of his permissible discretion, vast amount of discretion in deciding whether to grant or adjudicate a declaratory judgment. We believe that his ruling with respect to there not having been vilification or personal attack, which we believe is clearly right for the reasons that I've been discussing, does essentially moot that other issue. The only way in which Lorillard really conceivably could be injured by use of the base fund, if there were anything wrong with it as a matter of the contract, would be if it had been a vehicle for denying them an opportunity to be heard with respect to whether these ads vilify or personally attack. But because the Vice Chancellor resolved that against them, they have no remaining injury, and I think it was appropriate for the Vice Chancellor not to go there. To the extent the court does wish to reach those, this court does wish to reach those issues, we think the contract is quite clear that there is no restriction on the use of the base fund. It's a much smaller fund than the National Public Education Fund. It's a fraction of that fund, and the language of the contract, which again was negotiated by Lorillard and not by the American Legacy Foundation, which wasn't a party, but the contract they agreed to in negotiating with the states limits all of the funds of the foundation with respect to lobbying and says no funds of the foundation may be used for lobbying. But when it turns to vilification and personal attack, it says the National Public Education Fund shall not be used for vilification or personal attack.
We don't have anything in the record, do we, that shows who drafted this particular provision for purposes of construing it against the drafter?
We don't, and I believe, Your Honor, that there are two reasons why that proposition, even if you could figure that out, would not be material here. The first is the prohibition against considering negotiations, which the contract itself contains, and the second, I believe that canon is specifically ruled out by the contract and says that it shall not be construed against anyone. I would remark, though, that the one entity in this courtroom other than yourselves that we know didn't negotiate or propose that term was the American Legacy Foundation, which didn't exist at the time the contract was drafted, and Lorillard was there and drafted it. So if you were going to indulge a presumption, I think it would be against Lorillard and in favor of the non-party who's being attached to the contract. And certainly I think another canon which would in general cause one to construe the contract in favor of my client, is the general presumption against inferring waivers of First Amendment rights. This contract, to the extent that it prohibits my client from uttering truths, is a constraint, a voluntary constraint, if you will, on its First Amendment activity. But it is a well-established canon of construction, and the case law we cite in our brief shows this, that waivers of First Amendment rights are strictly construed against waiver. So, again, another reason to construe vilification and personal attack very narrowly.
That was not written out of the contract.
Construing consistent with its stated purposes is not written out of the contract. Indeed, one would suppose that was exactly what was intended by stating the core purposes of the contract. Construing in favor of public policy, not written out of the contract. Considering context and avoiding redundancy, reading words out of the contract, that also is in the contract, and I want to talk about that for just a minute, because context is what my colleague talked about a great deal. And I've talked about canons of construction, which I think totally support what the Vice Chancellor did. But context strongly supports it as well, because there are three words that are at issue here: vilification, personal, and attack. And it is a core principle of jurisprudence that words must be construed, that a contract should be construed to give each word independent meaning. Lorillard's interpretation, in the end, boils down to a prohibition on attacks on persons, companies, or governmental agencies. And attacks, by the way, constituting nothing more than criticism of the mildest sort. You don't need any vilification. If that's what a personal attack is, you don't need vilification. And it doesn't matter how much you water down vilification. Nothing's going to be vilification that isn't also that. So we don't need it. And no matter how, you know, they haven't found any ad that vilifies that isn't a personal attack, and it's obvious why. Vilification is irrelevant under their interpretation. And that's a strong reason not to adopt their interpretation under black-letter contract law. They also read personal completely out of the agreement. For them, personal means any negative criticism or portrayal of, and this is the phrase, characteristics, traits, ethics, or conduct. Well, that covers it. You're not going to narrow the category of attacks by saying that it has to be on characteristics, traits, ethics, or conduct, because there is no conceivable aspect of a person, company, or governmental agency that isn't one of those four things. And so you don't need it.
Now, the FCC rule did not have conduct in it. So do you subscribe to the FCC rule as being an accurate definition?
We don't think that the FCC rule is. There are any number of reasons why, if we were actually applying the FCC rule as the FCC did, none of these ads would violate it. And they're, we think, creatures of – we think that rule is entirely a creature of a different time and place, and that it really doesn't provide a good guide. This contractual provision prohibits personal attacks on persons companies or governmental agencies, and it is very important that each of these words be given a function. The definition provided in the FCC was in the context of different language, and in fact, the word personal attack in that rule only appeared in the title. It didn't actually appear in the text. The text itself described what it was that they were prohibiting, and the FCC applied it in ways that required a great deal of specificity, for example. And a great deal of very specific targeting that you simply don't see in the foundation's advertising in order to violate that rule. But we think that the right place to go is not to the FCC, but is to go specifically to the contract, to the words that were chosen and the words that were not chosen, not criticism or disparagement. And another very important point that I want to be sure is not overlooked about what words were not chosen. At the time the MSA, and this is another quite relevant data point in trying to decide this matter, at the time the MSA was negotiated, there was an extant model agreement between a state and the tobacco companies concerning the putting out of a public service campaign. It was an earlier negotiated settlement between the state of Florida and the tobacco companies, in which money that was provided in that settlement was to be used for a campaign. Now, the words that were selected were subsequently superseded by a most favored nation clause, and when Minnesota negotiated a deal that had no such restriction, Florida's was overridden.
Well, what's the legal principle that allows us to even consider that document?
Well, I think the legal principle is that other words are available that could convey the meaning that Lorillard is arguing for than the ones selected. And the words that were used there were that no advertising could be directed against tobacco companies at all. That directed against language is what Mr. Parkins is arguing for. It's utterly different than the words that were selected by the parties, which, again, have, in their typical usage, as the Vice Chancellor observed, a very extreme quality. Now, if I may, I'd like to play a couple of ads that are also ads that Lorillard says violate this agreement to show the sweep and breadth and to give you, I think, a feeling for, first, why these ads don't vilify or personally attack, and second, I hope, why, speaking in its own idiom, perhaps not in a way that adults find to be appealing, but in a way maybe if we harken back to our youth, get a sense of why these ads would appeal and make some impact. Could you start with I'd like to play two ads. Let's just play the first one and the second one. Yeah.
People who live in that geographic region recognize that building?
I think it's certainly possible that some people could recognize that building. It's the Philip Morris headquarters in New York. But the point of it is...
Well, can you have a personal attack without identifying Philip Morris by name?
I think if it were if it met the other definitions of personal attack and it were clear that that's what the ad were about, then the personal identification element of personal attack could be met. But as the Court of Chancery said, it has to be a particularly hostile or bitter matter directed to the personal, not the commercial aspect, to some private element. Vilification is addressed to the public element, but it requires that there be some element of falsity. And that ad says to kids, first of all, look at what 1,200 people are. This is very real. It's an attempt to dramatize that. And it's an attempt to do it in the kids' own voices, with them taking charge of their own destiny, to tell the tobacco companies, not as in Demon Awards, to suggest that the tobacco companies are reveling in it, but instead to say, you need to be aware of this as a way for kids to take control of their destiny. That's an extraordinarily effective ad. Then an ad connected to it, and there are several like this, tie that theme, the theme of how much death is caused by this, to tobacco advertising. It's just very important for kids to understand this message, that these ads are misleading, to have that as part of their understanding, and to allow them to take control and to reject tobacco. That's what these ads are about. I'd like to reserve what little I have left, if I may, Your Honor.
And we have 34 seconds.
All right. Thank you.
I'll try to make good use of it. I'd like to begin with body bags, which is the ad which you have just seen. It, of course, presents a situation where people are yelling through a megaphone at tobacco company employees, telling them they want to see what 1,200 people look like, even if they're in body bags, and implying strongly that the tobacco company executives don't care, that they're callous. What you didn't hear was that this ad was pulled from its rotation by ALF because of the concerns that it violated the MSA. And, in fact, there are notes in the file which indicate that that the Attorney General's Tobacco Ad Committee agreed with the industry assessment of these types of ads. And, in fact, once it was pulled from the rotation, the Attorney General of Michigan wrote to ALF, and the Attorney General of Michigan, by the way, was actually one of the people who negotiated this agreement. And the Attorney General of Michigan wrote and complained about pulling this from this rotation and wrote that it is, quote, a general but powerful vilification. It was after that that ALF succumbed to the pressure and reinstated these ads in a rotation, but only after resorting to the artifice of pretending these are funded by the base fund payments.
Now, in that ad, is your concern that they've used the actual building of a tobacco company? Let's suppose they did the exact same thing with a nondescript building in the middle of anywhere you want to pick.
No. My concern is you cannot use base fund payments to fund the advertisements. And if you do, they're still subject to the limitations contained in 6H.
I understand. But tell me your specific concern about the body bag advertisement. Is it the depiction of an actual headquarters?
Well, it's and it's portrayed, I think, implicitly, if not explicitly, as a tobacco headquarters. I heard Mr. Ogden say you could recognize it as Philip Morris's headquarters if you lived in that area. But in any event, it's the portrayal of it as a tobacco, or the implication is a tobacco headquarters. Those are tobacco employees, and somebody's shouting up at them as if they don't care upstairs. This is what 1,200 body bags look like. That. The other matter which is was raised is that the so-called core purpose of the agreement would, I'll call for a broad reading of the limitations in the MSA. The court below made no finding that the core purpose of the agreement would require or that ALF run the offending ads in order to reduce youth smoking. The court, and in fact, the ALF's own experts could not say that it was necessary for ALF to run the offending ads in order to reduce youth smoking. And I showed you an example of a non-offending ad that would obviously have the same sort of result. The point being that there has been no finding and there is no basis in the record to conclude that it is necessary, as I say, to run these offending ads to achieve the core purpose. There was a reference to the fact that we don't distinguish between vilification and personal attack and that these terms clearly must have different meanings. There are lots of instances in this particular agreement where there is a belt and suspenders approach. And the agreement will use terms that overlap. For example, it uses that there is a prohibition in there against ALF conducting political activity and lobbying. Again, those terms clearly overlap, and it's not a problem if the terms vilification and personal attack overlap. There was a reference to the fact that we cited the FCC rule, which defines personal attack. And counsel said that that was from a product of a different time and place. But
your definition has conduct in it, and the FCC rule does not. Isn't that so?
Yes. But
well, which one? You're not advocating the FCC rule. You're advocating something broader than that.
We're advocating, though, but the core is the comment on the characteristics of integrity, things of that nature. That is the core of the definition that we rely upon. And what is ironic is that Alf says that that's of a different time and place and yet supports the trial court's analysis, which in large part turned on two Delaware cases, which are 125 and 168 years old.
And one day our cases will be old, too.
Yes.
We're hoping people will still cite them.
Yeah. In conclusion, Your Honor, we're confronted here with a situation in which ALF, from its very inception, has adopted an advertising program which its documents show the underlying theme of was industry attack. Its board of directors decided that it was that these ads violated and pulled them off, and then were met with a firestorm of opposition from the anti-smoking community. So they reinstated them using the artifice of the base fund payment. What we are looking for is not to dismantle ALF's program. What we are not looking for is to cripple an anti-smoking campaign. What we're simply looking for is the benefit of our bargain. Unless the court has any further questions, I've concluded my presentation.
I have one. What's your response to the presumption against restriction, First Amendment restriction?
I think this is a matter not of First Amendment, but of contract law, and I don't think that these terms ought to be read in light of any constitutional provision. This is a deal between private parties.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very quickly, Your Honor. The Lorillard has not argued that any of these ads violate the Vice Chancellor's definition or the one that we've put forward. Their case rises or falls on their definition and selling it. And they have not offered any reason to select theirs over the Vice Chancellor's. Not a single reason has been offered by them. On our side, we've offered numerous, the dictionaries and their meaning, giving each word a function within the contract, and the fundamental purposes of the agreement, which you don't need fact-finding. Just look at the agreement to find it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you all. The court appreciates your briefs and your oral arguments, and we'll take this matter under advisement, and we'll also take a short recess. Please rise.